Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Anne Ball, and Phil Dierking. Later, Jill Robbins and John Russell will bring us this week's lesson in everyday grammar. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
The Trump administration is being criticized for giving a top political advisor a seat on the President's National Security Council, or NSC. Trump recently signed an order making changes to the NSC, which advises the President on national security issues and foreign policy. The order gave Trump's top strategist, Steve Bannon, a seat on the NSC's Principals Committee. The Principals Committee also includes top cabinet officials, including the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense. The order also changed a requirement for other members of the Principals Committee, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Director of National Intelligence. These individuals will no longer be required to attend all meetings of the committee. They will only have to attend when issues pertaining to their responsibilities and expertise are to be discussed. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer was asked whether the changes amounted to a demotion for the two officials. He called that idea nonsense. He said the order did not change the fact that those positions are still part of the NSC. Spicer added that the change will allow the officials to avoid some meetings that don't directly relate to their departments. Most of the criticism of Trump's NSC reorganization has focused on Bannon. He was a close political advisor to Trump throughout his campaign and was appointed as his top strategist in the White House. Leon Panetta served in past administrations as Secretary of Defense and director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He told CNN he was concerned about Trump giving a seat on the NSC to a political advisor. The purpose of the NSC is to provide the president with the best advice from the top national security experts, Panetta said. It isn't to have a political advisor who is going to make recommendations based on what polls well. That's the worst thing you could do. Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine serves on the Select Committee on Intelligence. She told Maine Public Radio, Bannon does not have the expertise that the Director of National Intelligence or the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff have, and this is entirely inappropriate. Senator John McCain, a Republican from Arizona, praised Trump's national security team overall, but he criticized the choice of Bannon. He called the appointment a radical departure from any National Security Council in history. Spicer responded to the criticisms by pointing out Bannon's experience in the Navy and with international affairs. He is a former naval officer. He's got a tremendous understanding of the world and the geopolitical landscape that we have now, Spicer told ABC's This Week. He added that having the chief strategist for the president in those meetings, who has a significant military background, to help make and guide what the president's final analysis is going to be, is crucial. Some critics have cited a part of U.S. law that outlines the legal structure of the NSC. The law mentions a requirement for NSC members to be appointed by the president, as well as by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. However, some legal experts who studied Trump's order have concluded that Bannon likely does not require approval from the U.S. Senate to sit on the NSC committee. One expert noted that Trump's order designates Bannon as an invitee to attend all meetings of the NSC, but not as a full member of the committee. Legal scholar Lawrence Tribe from America's Harvard University Law School tweeted his opinion on the issue. He said he does not believe Bannon needs Senate confirmation to serve on the Principals Committee, which, in his words, isn't part of the NSC as such. Tribe added that the role Bannon has been given is crazy and dangerous, but it doesn't seem to violate any law, though it probably should. Democratic Senator Mark Warner of Virginia announced he will introduce legislation to clarify who can legally serve on the NSC. He called Trump's choice of Bannon misguided and deeply troubling. Warner's bill would require congressional approval for a non-Senate confirmed political choice, such as Bannon, to the NSC. However, the legislation has little chance of passing in the Republican-controlled Congress. I'm Brian Lynn.
President Donald Trump's chief political strategist, Steve Bannon, has received much media attention since starting his job at the White House. Last week, Trump reorganized his National Security Council to give Bannon a seat on its Principals Committee. Lawmakers and former administration officials criticized the move. They said Bannon should focus on his role as political advisor instead of attending meetings with national security and military officials. Bannon also recently spoke out against the U.S. news media in an interview with the New York Times. He said, "The media here is the opposition party." He added that he believes that news organizations had been humiliated by the 2016 presidential election result. "They don't understand this country. They still do not understand why Donald Trump is the president of the United States," Bannon said. He was not immediately available for an interview with VOA. Bannon was born in November 1953 to working-class parents in Norfolk, Virginia. He once described growing up in a blue-collar Irish Catholic, pro-Kennedy, pro-Union family of Democrats. His father, a telephone worker, was badly affected by the 2008 economic crisis. Bannon himself has criticized bankers and traders who were not punished for their role in starting the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression of the 1930s. Bannon studied urban affairs at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. According to the Boston Globe newspaper, Bannon returned home to Richmond, Virginia during the summer to work in a local junkyard. He went on to earn a graduate degree from Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and later a master's in business administration from Harvard University. Bannon served for 7 years in the U.S. Navy aboard ships. He also served on a guided missile destroyer in the Persian Gulf. Later, he was a special assistant to the chief of naval operations in the Pentagon. After his military service, Bannon went to work for investment bank Goldman Sachs. He later started his own investment company. He also produced films in Hollywood. Bannon produced more than a dozen movies during the 1990s. During that time, he made a deal that gave him a piece of ownership of several television shows. One of them was the hit show Seinfeld, which ended up making him millions of dollars. Before joining Trump's campaign, Bannon served as executive chairman of Breitbart News, a conservative news site. He took over the site after founder Andrew Breitbart died in 2012. Bannon has described the news site as a platform for what has been called the alternative right or alt-right. The alt-right is a far-right movement that publicizes, largely on the internet, extreme conservative ideas. Under Bannon's leadership, the website published stories supporting nationalist, anti-establishment positions. It also published many stories in support of Trump and others critical of Hillary Clinton, the Democratic presidential candidate. I'm Ann Ball.
More than 1 million international students are studying in the United States. Many of them find it helpful to have a smartphone and an American credit card. These things make it easy to pay for many kinds of goods and services. But getting a credit card as an international student is not a simple process. Normal U.S. lenders ask for a Social Security number. They also ask to see a person's credit history. This helps the lenders trust that someone is responsible and will make timely payments. These are the things most international students do not have. But one company is trying to make the process easier and fairer for them. Jack Gua is from China. He now studies at a university in California. He says having an American credit card makes it easier for students to get around town. And, he says, credit cards are important for international students who hope to live in the country in the future.
A lot of my friends who have had the cars already, because it's pretty important to get around on LA. And also, if you are going to stay here afterwards for job, for internship, for career, you know, of course you are going to consider to buying a property to live here. And having a credit is pretty important. You want to get a loan.
In some countries, paper money, or cash, remains a common way to pay for goods. But in the United States, people often use credit cards. They have become even more common with the rise of e-commerce. Kalpesh Kapadia came from India to study at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He faced the same difficulties that many international students face when trying to get an American credit card. He decided to open SelfScore. The company has a different way of measuring a person's financial trustworthiness, Kapadia says. Instead of asking for credit history and a social security number, SelfScore looks at documents such as passports, visas, and acceptance letters to American schools. The company also considers a student's ability to pay.
The traditional system was designed in 20th century, before internet, before smartphone, before social media, and it's kind of antiquated. We are inventing a new system.
About 10,000 international students from more than 66 countries now have credit cards through SelfScore. Kapadia says less than 1% of SelfScore's credit card holders are past due on their payments. He calls international students highly motivated or driven to succeed.
This is a highly motivated population. Someone who comes here 10,000 miles away to make their life better through education is going to behave quite differently.
I'm Phil Dierking.
Here's what's trending today. Pennsylvania's world-famous groundhog, Punxsutawney Phil, predicted 6 more weeks of winter on Thursday after seeing his shadow. This event is part of an American tradition called Groundhog Day. It takes place every February 2nd in the small Pennsylvanian town of Punxsutawney. Since 1886, thousands of people have come together on this day on a hill called Gobbler's Knob. They watch as a groundhog named Phil predicts the length of the winter season. Today was the 131st official Groundhog Day. A groundhog is a large rodent and part of a family known as marmots. On Groundhog Day, Phil the groundhog comes out of a hole in the earth just after sunrise. As the tradition goes, Phil will then look for his shadow on the ground. If he sees his shadow, there will be 6 more weeks of cold weather during winter. If Phil does not see his shadow, warmer weather will arrive soon. The story of Groundhog Day comes from an early Christian European tradition, says John Griffiths. He helps take care of Phil, the groundhog.
That stems from the tradition of Candlemas. February 2nd actually is the halfway point of winter. In Europe, they would melt their candles down and make new candles, and it was basically a day for communities and folks to get together.
Griffiths said that when European settlers came to Pennsylvania from Germany, they held on to that tradition. They decided that the groundhog was the best animal to continue the tradition. The town of Punxsutawney held its first Groundhog Day in 1886. But the first official Groundhog Day at Gobbler's Knob
happened the next year, in 1887. Phil is taken care of by a local group known as Phil's Inner Circle. Griffiths is a member of the Inner Circle. He says the group helps pull Phil out of the hole on Groundhog Day. The members also take care of the day-to-day activities of the Groundhog Club. The Groundhog Club organizes the annual celebration. Phil has become very important for the town of Punxsutawney. This year, between 15,000 to 20,000 people came to town for the celebration. The event helps support the local economy. Many people say that Punxsutawney Phil is always correct with his weather predictions. Elaine Owen traveled to Punxsutawney from Greenwich, Pennsylvania. It was her first time coming to the event.
It's just been a tradition that everybody says that the groundhog is very accurate, so whatever he predicts is what happens.
As the story goes, the groundhog that appeared in this year's event is the same groundhog that saw its shadow in 1886. Phil is able to live so long because he drinks groundhog punch, made from a secret recipe. One sip is given to Phil every summer. It is enough to give him many more years of life. The Storm Facts website looked back at Punxsutawney Phil's predictions over the years. It found Phil has been correct 39% of the time. He usually predicts 6 more weeks of winter weather. Griffiths says Groundhog Day means more to people than just predicting the weather.
It's not religious, it's not political, it's all about having fun. It's a time of the year that gives everybody a chance to get out and for one day cast all their cares off and have a good time.
Visitors agree. One visitor who went by the nickname of Winter says the event helps bring the community together.
I think it brings a community together. People get excited. Generally speaking, Groundhog Day is something that for a very long time has brought communities together.
Whether it is for the community, the weather prediction, or just the tradition itself, Groundhog Day is one of America's most unusual celebrations. And that's what's trending today. From VOA Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. Imagine two American students are talking outside of their school. Let's listen to the imaginary conversation.
Today is going slow.
Yeah, I guess we should study for our grammar test.
That sounds like a terrible idea.
Yeah, but if we don't study, we won't do good on the test.
Fine. Let's go study our notes quick. Then we can play video games.
These bad students may hate grammar, but they just taught you some common grammatical structures in conversational American English. In today's report, we will study how conversational grammar differs from written and formal grammatical structures. We will show you how some Americans use adjectives and adverbs in casual conversation.
Adjectives are words that give information about nouns. They generally appear before nouns, although they also appear after linking verbs. Here are two examples.
You are a good student.
Learning English is fun.
In the two example sentences, the words good and fun are adjectives. They are telling you something about a noun. Adverbs are often used to modify adjectives or verbs. They give information about reason, manner, time, and so on. For example, the adverb loudly appears in this sentence.
We sang loudly.
The adverb loudly modifies the past tense verb sang. It tells about the way in which the subject, we, sang. Adverbs often have an ly ending, but there are many that do not. You can read more about adverbs in past Everyday Grammar stories.
Let's think back to the conversation we heard at the beginning of the story.
Today is going slow.
Yeah, I guess we should study for our grammar test.
That sounds like a terrible idea.
Yeah, but if we don't study, we won't do good on the test.
Fine. Let's go study our notes quick. Then we can play video games.
Notice that the words are used differently from what might be taught in an English class. In casual conversation, Americans often use adjective forms in place of adverbs. They may use adjective forms to modify verbs. For example, the students use good, a word that is normally an adjective, as an adverb. One student says, "We won't do good on the test." In writing and in formal conversation, Americans generally do not use the word good this way. Instead, they use the word well. In formal writing or speaking, you would be more likely to see or hear the sentence, "We won't do well on the test." Americans also may use an adverb, but choose not to say an ly ending. For example, the student says, "Today is going slow," instead of "Today is going slowly." You would be more likely to read slowly in academic writing, write Susan Conrad and Douglas Biber, two English grammar experts.
These grammatical structures are not necessarily slang. They are not necessarily impolite either. You might hear some of these structures in a restaurant, at a job fair, or even at work. For example, a boss might tell an employee, "We need to do this quick," about a project that must be completed quickly. This is the same pattern that the students used in their conversation. Conrad and Biber say that in formal speech and writing, adjective forms are almost never used to modify verbs. In addition, adverbs with ly endings are more common in writing, particularly in academic and news writing.
The good news is this. We are not asking you to memorize any of the patterns we have talked about today. What we hope to do is show you that the grammatical patterns in conversation do not always match the patterns used in formal writing or speech. There is more flexibility in casual speech. Understanding this idea will help you understand Americans when they speak, and it will help you sound more natural when you speak to Americans. You might also be pleased to know that Americans will not judge you severely if you use an adjective in place of an adverb. In fact, they probably would do the same. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.